Bloghawk Radio.
It's Blog Talk Radio. No, it's rebooting the news.
It's rebooting the news with Blog Talk Radio. What?
Should we say again? Or?
Why? Okay. Oh, Adrian wants to. You see, this is the awkward moment, Jay.
No, this is the amateur professionalism.
Amateur. Or is it professional amateurism?
Professional amateurism. Welcome to Rebooting the News number 81, Dave. We do have a bit of a different opening. Why don't you explain
well,
why?
Well, we don't have Blog Talk Radio, and the short version of that is that when I tried to create the show today, this morning, the episode, it said that in order to do a 45-minute show, we would have to do we'd have to have a premium account. And so I thought this was a mistake, and I sent an email to the CEO of the company, who is a friend of mine, Alan Levy, and said, Alan, I didn't say this was a mistake, though.
Mm-hmm.
I just said...
what's going on?
Yeah, I sent him a screenshot mm-hmm. with a pointer at the error message, and he said, well, it's because you need to have a premium account.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, thanks for clarifying, and end of discussion. So then the question, of course, comes up, well, now, what's the price? And so I looked it up. The price was $39 a month.
Right.
And only $399 if you buy a whole year. And so then the question is it worth what we get out of it? Is it worth $39 a month? And I think we both decided whether that isn't really the issue. Of course, to some people, it is worth way more than $39 a month. I'm mm-hmm. not questioning the value of their system, but to us, it is not worth that.
We're not making any money off
this. Well, that's for sure. And
$50 a year, I'm sure I would do that.
Are we negotiating?
Right? No, I'm just saying.
Really? Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. You know, my feeling, I had a chance to look at this, and it's not, it is a teaching moment, because, you know, in the context of, I think, everything that we talk about on this show, is that this should be a good moment. It's, oh, okay, we get a chance to pay for it. Then we get treated like a customer, and I can't complain. We've been treated pretty well by Blog Talk
Radio. Well, the marketplace is working, right?
Right. And so then the question is, we hope, is the question for me is, well, do you like it? And the answer is I don't. I mm-hmm. don't like Blog Talk Radio as a piece of software.
Mm-hmm.
And if I did, I think I would be happy. Like Dropbox, for example. I give them money, even though I don't use the features that you have to pay money for.
Uh-huh.
I think I might use the features, and I give them the money because the software is a joy. It's just absolute joy. It mm-hmm. does exactly what I want it to do, and it works. And if Blog Talk Radio were really simple, you know,
yeah.
and if you know, this is how would I gauge that? If I feel like doing a podcast, how many steps is it for me to actually do it?
And if you want to have a guest call in,
right.
How easy is it?
Well, we failed utterly at that last week.
Right.
I mean, this was a bad time to be asking us for money. Somewhere in that mess, something screwed up, and we still don't know what it is. We did eventually get the show off, but it was horrible.
So the search is on for alternatives, right?
Right, yeah. Or, yes, we're looking for alternatives.
And if anyone knows of one, they're welcome to contact
right.
us.
Right, so now what we're looking for, to be clear, is we're not looking for a full podcast solution. People have suggested that. We don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is something that can allow people to listen to the show while it's being recorded live.
Yes.
That's really what we
need.
And
what about the call-in, Peter?
And the call-in, right. We need the call-in sometimes.
Right.
The most important thing about the call-in, though, is that it's got to be like 100% reliable because we're not going to really have a chance to test it.
Mm-hmm.
The first time we test it, it's going to be a show. And we're going to have somebody who we care about who's calling in.
Let me ask you a question, and it would require some speculation on your part. But what do you think the... what is it, $39 a month?
Yeah.
So that's $400, $500 a year? What market is that price point aimed at?
You know, I don't really understand. I mean, if you look at the homepage, my guess is as good as yours. I mean, what do you think it is? I mean, if you look at the homepage of Blog Talk Radio, what you see is you see a lot of featured programs look very much like the talk radio stuff. So
uh-huh.
Let's say you were running a talk radio show like, you know, something they have on WNBC or if they still have that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't listen to AM radio in New York, but if they still had it, that, you know. So if you had 50,000 people listening and, you know, you had to deal with 50 callers per show,
mm-hmm.
Blog Talk Radio can do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, if that's what you're doing, sure, it's worth $39 a month. That's nothing, you know.
Right, I guess that's right.
You know, you're making, this is your business, this is what you're doing, it's a livelihood, and that is transitioning to the internet. That's a rebooting the news story right there, you know, and the fact that he's charging for it is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
I feel we're doing, by having their ad up front in the beginning of our show,
right,
we're more than paying our way, mm-hmm. I feel, you know, and I don't think we needed to have that. I did it first because I'm a sentimental guy. I don't like changing things. I'm conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like the idea of some person.
Yeah, we gave him a lot of branding, but this is the marketplace. If we don't want to pay it, we don't pay it. And
right. Let's not get sentimental about it.
Yeah, let's not get outraged about it.
No, I was teary-eyed for like about a moment or so. Then I got over it.
All right.
We're moving on now.
Let's move on.
Yeah, we're moving on.
Big news broke at 12:01 last night. I was actually sleeping when it happened.
Yeah, me too, of course.
But I heard it on the radio when I woke up at 6:40.
Yep.
AOL is acquiring Huffington Post for $315 million. And equally important in that announcement is that Arianna Huffington will become the editor-in-chief of AOL's editorial properties, including TechCrunch.
Why does everybody think that's so hilarious?
It's just funny. If you know the people,
yeah,
it's just funny.
Yeah, poor Mike Arrington.
Well, including TechCrunch.
You know that meeting will never take place.
Yes, of course.
You understand that,
and
right?
Patch.com and AOL Finance and Politics Daily, which will die a merciful death.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's just going to be gone.
Won't Huffington Post die a merciful death? I mean,
what?
You know,
why
that's,
would you say that?
Well,
then?
I mean, that's the obvious. I mean, there's so many questions that come from this.
Well, let's start picking some of them apart.
Well,
what are some?
Well,
of the
first
questions?
Of all, do you really believe that Arianna Huffington is going to be the chief editorial person at AOL? I don't.
Why not?
I think that's a press release.
Really?
I think that's how these things work. I think that on the event, you make a big statement like that, and then
mm-hmm.
the reality is something different from that. When she shows up at work on Monday, does. Well, as you said, does Mike Arrington report to work? Yes, Miss Huffington.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what would you like me to do next? Can I get you some coffee? You know, we don't see that happening, right?
Right.
It's not going to happen. I mean, you know, I've seen lots of acquisitions, and this is a tech industry acquisition.
Yes.
Right. I mean, it's tech being in content, but it's still tech. I'll give you an example. When I sold my company to Symantec in 1987. I got in my agreement, in writing, that I would be the chief Mac architect for the company because we were bringing them the Mac market. That
mm-hmm.
was our. We were actually a big company in the Mac market at the mm-hmm. time, and the Mac market was, that's why they were buying us. And the first day I showed up at work and started throwing around my weight as the chief Mac architect, somebody said, "What are you doing?" I pointed them to my agreement. They said, "Oh, you took that seriously?"
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing serious about it. It's mm-hmm. it's a press release. It's a way to tell the press and the users that this is something, the significance of it. But it won't happen that way. I don't think it'll happen that way.
Well, who will be the editor-in-chief of AOL?
I don't think there is such a thing.
There won't be one. There'll just be different fiefdoms,
what do
different
you,
brands.
You're the J-School prof here. What does an editor-in-chief do, Jay?
Well, the most important thing would be to pick all the other editors and to be able to fire them if they're not doing the job and to replace them with people who do things the way you want them done.
But isn't implicit in editor-in-chief role that there is some management structure that sort of meets on a regular basis? I think of Perry White at, you know, the Daily Planet as the editor-in-chief. That they have their daily meeting and they you know, he says, well, I'll give business this space
on
the front page.
Well, that's the editor-in-chief of a particular editorial property, yes. But an editor-in-chief of a company
really?
Is a little bit different.
Why do they have the same title?
Well, the editor in chief of a company is actually a better title because that's sort of what they are. But I think the main thing would be to pick the people and to ensure that they're all operating with the same mix of inputs.
Okay.
So I don't know. I mean, maybe it won't happen. I kind of wonder.
Maybe it will. I'd be the first to say it might. Yeah.
Everything Ariana has done has surprised people who doubted her.
Absolutely.
So I would not doubt her.
Not the least of which was Huffington Post.
Yes.
And okay, so let's go to the other question.
Yeah.
Another huge question is, okay, now we know Ariana makes some huge portion of $315 million.
Yes.
And those of us who have written for Huffington Post get zero.
Yeah.
And we knew that we were going to get zero, but what we right. didn't know was that she was going to get $315 million.
We didn't?
No, we didn't. And in fact,
well,
if you
I
look
was
at
assume that was what was she was driving towards.
Well, you're a very smart, astute fellow, Jay. Let me say that right up front.
Well,
but
you didn't know Huffington Post was going to be sold?
Oh, I'm astute and bright, too. I mean, okay, don't get me wrong.
Come on,
wrong.
That's been
but
pretty,
there
pretty
is
clear.
A lot of people on Twitter this morning saying, well, wait a minute. What is this, you know, is this right that she makes all this money and then the people who made the whole thing work get nothing? And this
uh-huh.
is a recurring theme
right.
in these online communities.
So when Facebook goes public, all the people who've been putting all their stuff into Facebook are going to say, hey, how come I didn't get a piece of that deal?
Yeah, so there'll be some of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
when Twitter is sold, people are going to say, hey, I've been...
I made Twitter, right.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a joke, really. It's a serious concern. It's sort of is another face of overall the, you know, sort of the big thing that's been happening the last couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see, you know, it's the same idea is that, you know, the country Egypt could shut off the internet. And, you know, that's just the first crude approximation of how they stopped the organizing. They could have just shut off Facebook and Twitter.
Well, it does show us that what we think of as the commons is either actually the property of a company, like a shopping mall,
right.
or it is under the control of the state. And what is true about both these events is that we really don't have the digital commons yet. We think we do. We can glimpse it. We want it. We need it. And there are visionaries around who talk about it, but as a
they're
social fact, it's not there.
They're not talking about it anymore. Nobody's talking about it. It's not. So I think you can revise that statement. There's nobody talking about the commons and those idealistic terms. It's not real. I think the thing that you can strive for, though, is that the users in the country should know what's going on.
Yeah.
Okay? For example, in China, they probably don't know that the government is filtering out every reference to Egypt on their version of the internet. They probably don't know that. And so that's one sort of level of understanding of knowledge.
Well, did contributors to the Huffington Post know that they weren't going to be paid and
well,
get a payday?
No. Let me just go. That's not the point. The yin and the yang is the people of Egypt knew
yeah.
that their internet got cut off.
Yes.
Okay? So that created pressure on the government to put it back on.
Right.
There is no pressure on the Chinese government to take that thing off, the filtering of Egypt, because people don't even know it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's not...
It's a different situation.
You
yeah.
want to force... That's right. And, you know, in terms of if you are on the side of the people, okay, which I think both you and I are, what you want to do is you want to force the government and the corporations, if they want to shut off organizing, if they want to shut off a revolution, they should have to shut off the internet.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the acid test. If they have to shut off the internet, you're doing it right. If they can do it by making a backroom deal with Mark Zuckerberg, and I'm pretty sure we know that Mark Zuckerberg will do that deal, okay? And the Twitter guys are sort of on the fence about this. They say they won't do it, but I don't know that push come to shove whether they... I'm pretty sure they will do it when they're forced to do it, okay? But if the deal is... If we're using the internet properly, they will have to shut off the internet.
Yeah. Well, that's why I felt when they did shut down the internet a couple of weeks ago, it was the most clear sign the government could give to its citizens
right.
that there's a civic emergency here.
Right now,
you created a civic emergency.
That's correct, but
yeah.
the government doesn't want to give that information to the citizens. So right now, Kleiner Perkins and Sequoia and Union Square Ventures are all starting companies to create products to sell. I'm making this up, by the way. But to despots, to people who that allow them great filters, a dashboard, if you will, mm-hmm. that very selectively turns off pieces of the internet mm-hmm. because the governments don't. That now they understood. The Egyptian government beforehand didn't understand. Had you come knocking on their door saying you really need this tool, mm-hmm. they'd go, well, how much? And they say, we don't need it. You mm-hmm. know, no matter what the price is. Today, if you go to whatever, you know.
Right, the kill switch now is.
They don't want a kill switch, Jay. What they want is they want really good filtering. The kill switch is bad for them, for the government, because it gets the people out in the streets.
Uh-huh.
You want them not to know. And that's our defense against that, is to make that make that impossible.
Yeah.
And that we can do.
Yeah.
That's not the, you know. So you're going to see all this. The governments are figuring, I'm sure they're figuring it out, that they have their natural alliance with the corporations, with the corporate blogging silos. They should be partners. And I think to the credit, I think Facebook's been pretty clear about this in the last couple of weeks. They don't really want people plotting revolutions on Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, and when because he just got back from China, where presumably there were negotiations going on the terms on which they would turn Facebook back on. And I guarantee you that dashboard was part of the deal.
But there's something in Facebook, a kernel, let's say. I'm not saying it's the dominant strain, but there is something in Facebook that connects it to human rights in the sense that what's common across all the cultures where Facebook has spread is human nature itself. And the fact that people want to keep in touch, as Zuckerberg often says, with family and friends, people they know.
Yeah.
And because Facebook operates out of this common element in human nature, there's a very short connection there, I mean, very tight connection with human rights. And so I don't think this is going to go away.
Well, you don't want to know what the connection is? The connection is that it's part of the internet.
Yeah.
And the internet gives it that.
Right.
They'll take that part out.
Well,
I guarantee you that's where they're going. That has to be where they're going. This Egypt thing is not just about Egypt.
True.
By any stretch of the imagination.
It's
about the net. And that's where the guys who say, oh, well, this would have happened without. Of course it would have happened without the net eventually. And it wouldn't have happened this way, though. And, you know, it's like saying that the telephone is a tool for revolution. Yes. It's a tool for revolution.
I'm just staggered by how stupid this debate is.
It's pretty stupid.
I just cannot believe that people are seriously arguing about whether Twitter or Facebook or any social media caused the revolution, and then seriously trying to debunk a notion that is absurd to begin with, and that these crazy-ass debunkers get this kind of traction with educated people who are trying to, like, position themselves as savvy realistic by knocking down these absurd claims. I mean, it's just so pathetic. To me, I want to put them all at the kids' table so that we can have an adult conversation about the actual role these tools in events.
We're making progress then. I mean, we really are, because you couldn't have said that 2-3 weeks ago. Couldn't have said it. It wouldn't have been taken seriously. You would probably not have said that, right?
I have been saying it.
Okay. Yeah. Here's one that would not have gained traction for sure. I wrote a piece, I think it was just yesterday actually, entitled "The Internet is for Revolution." I guarantee you that would have gotten attacked seriously by all, you know who would have attacked.
Are you a cyber utopian?
Exactly.
Have I been doing a show with a cyber utopian?
Exactly. Yeah. Here's the thing is nobody attacked it.
Uh-huh.
Because why? Because it's so obviously true. Now, it isn't any more true today than it was 2 weeks ago.
Right.
Okay? It was equally true 2 weeks ago or years ago. I mean, I've known this all along because I've seen it do revolutionary things. Over and over and over and over again. Since it's no surprise that it could be used for this. Now the question is, what part of it can be used for that, and what part can't? Those people don't want to participate in that discussion. It's okay, you know. I mean, yes, it's frustrating.
Yeah. Well, here's the way I look at it. in any situation where people revolt, from people in an office who have a shitty boss, right, to people who live under a terrible dictator, one of the factors is not just how dissatisfied an individual person is, but their opinion or guesstimate of how dissatisfied other people are, right?
Yeah.
That determines your willingness to act, your opinion of your own conditions, but also what you think other people are thinking. Now, if that's always been the case for thousands of years, hundreds of years, right? There's nothing different about that today. However, if you add tools that are very efficient at horizontal communication, so that you can find out what other people are thinking and inclined to do, it would stand to reason that it would have an effect on that part of, okay? And yet we still have to ask ourselves in concrete situations, okay, how much of a difference does that make, right? And I think that's a really important question. It's basically an empirical question. And that is where we should be placing our energies. But instead, what we have is, see, debunking provides a cheap high for people who want to be realistic. And I think the real appeal of the Malcolm Gladwells of the world, and he's just a symbol of it because there's many others who do the same thing.
He's very extreme, though.
He's extreme, yeah. But the appeal of it is, I think, that people are actually talking to themselves with these people, with these pieces, meaning that for a moment they were tempted by utopian or revolutionary ideas as well, and they're trying to almost like talk themselves down, or they're reacting to a part of themselves that surges with hope or idealism, and they're trying to make sure that they won't get fooled. But almost nobody, in my view, who's actually paying attention, who's trying to study this, who's trying to figure it out, who's worth debating, almost nobody drifts towards the cyber-utopian position, and almost nobody seriously thinks that these tools have no role. And so that's what I mean by the kids' table. Let's take everybody who wants to debate the cyber-utopian premise or its negation and put them at the kids' table, because that is a sandbox activity.
Well, good. I think we also ought to put Bill Keller at the kids' table as well.
Now, why do you say that?
I just
are
thought
you
I
trying
would
to
change,
be provocative?
I thought I would change the subject.
Okay, let's
I know
change
you
the
were,
subject.
I know you were there at the seminar.
I was.
At Columbia.
Yeah.
I didn't go. I watched the webcast. I didn't go because I knew I would say something. And
were
I
you at the Cambridge event?
I didn't go to that
Oh, you
either.
Didn't go. Oh, okay.
No, I didn't go. I finally decided, I saw the, I don't know if I want to go here. Oh, what the hell. I saw the list of people who were going to it, and I said, I don't need to be at this.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, I mean, I can extrapolate what the conversation is going to be about. And I think that it would have been, I don't know, because it's already happened, but this was an event on Thursday. The same day as the Columbia event at Shorenstein, which is part of the Kennedy School at Harvard. I think it would have been very much like the kids' table conversation you're talking about there. And it's fine. It's okay if they have it. I'm just not going to get on a train and go all the way up to Boston when a snowstorm is being predicted.
Right.
You know. And I didn't go to the Columbia thing for similar but not that dissimilar reasons, because I would have said something there, and I didn't want to live with the consequences of what I would have said. so I decided to err on the side of... So I sat at home and watched... This was based on having listened to Bill Keller on Fresh Air two days before this, and really having to, like, you know, go take some blood pressure medicine after.
Okay, so this is Bill Keller.
Bill Keller.
Alan Rusbridger of The Guardian.
Right.
And Emily Bell of Columbia.
And the guy from...
And Jack Goldsmith, who's a former Bush administration.
Yeah, well, he was more
Justice
tempered
Department
because
official.
Because Emily did a much better job of interviewing than Terry Gross
did. I thought she did a great job.
Yeah, I thought she did, too. And Terry Gross, I mean, I have lost, over the years, so much respect for her. I mean... and maybe she never deserved it, but that was just a absolute festival, the Fresh Air interview with Bill Keller, of just childish criticisms of Julian Assange, where he was basically echoing, he wrote a piece in the New York Times magazine that ran the Sunday before, mm-hmm. which apparently is an excerpt from a New York Times book.
Yeah,
which
both the Guardian and the Times have put out books about
right.
this episode.
And by the way, the Bill Keller piece was also optioned for a movie, so we're going to see a movie about Julian Assange's socks. You know, it was basically the story is you can't trust Julian Assange because he skips, because he doesn't bathe, and he smells bad as a result, and his socks are dirty. It was like, and then you found out at that seminar that Bill Keller has actually never met Julian Assange. So he's doing this all on hearsay. Somebody else is telling him about the skipping and the socks and the smelling bad.
Well,
and this is the worst thing. It's you know, it sounds funny and everything, and we can be derisive of him, but it isn't really funny, because what it is, it's taking the focus off of the memos, off of the cables,
yeah.
and putting it on a person. And, you know, they say that he's a cult figure, but he's not asking for them to look at his person. I've
right.
not heard him do that. Every time I've seen an interview with him, like the 60 Minutes interview, where I thought
that was a good interview. You thought it wasn't, but I thought
well,
that
I
was
thought
good.
He did great.
Yeah.
I thought he did phenomenal. I think Steve Croft ought to lose his license to practice journalism, if there was such a thing. Because, you know, every question that he asked...
That didn't bother me. He didn't bother me.
It bothered me because there are a lot more things that Julian Assange could talk about that would be more interesting
okay.
and far more useful, like the substance of the cables. Like, the real reason why he likes to do this stuff is because he wants people to know how screwed up that war in Iraq was.
Right.
Well, that's a pretty good reason to want to get that stuff out there. And maybe... take the guy at face value, you know?
Yeah.
That's the net effect of what he's done, is to inform us about this, that maybe that was the reason why he did it.
Well, let me tell you what I heard at the Columbia event that interested me.
Yeah.
First of all, Keller did say very clearly that if Assange is prosecuted, that's
yeah.
bad
Yeah,
us.
That was the first time I heard him say that.
He said it
and I appreciate
really
that.
Clearly.
Absolutely.
And
not kid table stuff.
Right.
That was serious adult stuff.
Uh-huh. Exactly. And what I found most interesting was we had two newspaper editors there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Two editors of probably the most important newspapers in the world today, in my view.
Mm.
And they were dealing with the same facts, right? Assange is Assange. They had dealt with him in similar ways. They had a common set of concerns to discuss. Which was the whole point of bringing them together. They'd both put out books on it. They had written similar articles.
They had both trashed him personally.
They had both had falling outs with him.
No, they both trashed him personally. The falling outs were their doing, Jay. They deliberately decided to have the fallout.
Yeah, I don't see it that way.
I do. But, I think I can pretty much convince you of it and prove, you know. I mean, Jay, when was the last time you saw them write a profile like that about a CEO of a tech company? You know, the New York Times has published far more about Twitter than they have about WikiLeaks, believe it or not. Have they ever told you what kind of socks Evan Williams wears? No.
No.
Would they ever? No. It would be disrespectful of the readers to do that. Never mind what it would mean to their access to the individual they're trying to talk to and report on. It would destroy access, and we both know that. They don't play those games with people who they care about.
Well, let me finish my observation.
Okay. But I just want to clear that up. They said this is just in the course of doing business. It is not. They don't do this in the course of doing business. They do it when they feel the person is vulnerable and they don't need him.
All right. That would not be my interpretation, but I agree that they don't necessarily treat valuable sources that
I'd
way.
I'd like to know who else they do. It doesn't have to be right now, but who else have they profiled that way? I don't think I've ever seen it. Maybe Milosevic.
Well, here's what interested me. Throughout the conversation, Keller, when confronted with problems of interpretation, like how do we describe WikiLeaks? How do we interpret this? What does this development mean? Would consistently try and claim that we've done this before, we've seen this before, it's not a disruption, there's nothing new. And Rusbridger was much more inclined to say, you know, this is a different world. This is a new balance of power. We haven't actually seen this before. And I just thought that's worth remarking on right there. The other thing I observed is that Keller consistently, and others at the New York Times too, have described Assange as a source. And I think that's a little bit bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, if he's a source, then who's Bradley Manning? And if he's a source like any other source, then you're really kind of misdescribing the situation, because
mm-hmm.
he's a source with the power to publish.
Mm-hmm.
He's a source that's getting information in himself. He's more of a broker than a source. But the reason why they describe him as a source is not because it's accurate. It's because that allows them to fit him into some world they know. Right, because we already know how to deal with sources,
mm-hmm.
right? And we already deal with sources who are somewhat nefarious, who have motives, who have agendas. We all know sources have agendas, right? This is, I think he actually said that word for word.
Well, that's what Steve Croft was so obsessed
with. And Steve Croft is the same.
Sources always have agendas. Agenda? Well, he asked it 15 million whatever times. Yeah.
So. I think the reason why they wrote these profiles and the smelly socks begins with they want to separate themselves from this source.
Right.
Because they think of the source as somewhat unsavory, somebody who's not
necessarily as trustworthy as they are. There's a couple of other explanations. I think what you're saying is plausible. It's quite possible. That's what one of the reasons why I thought they were going to feed him up to the federal government was to draw this distinction between him and them. So, okay, it's fine. I thought this
might be...
But
they wouldn't do that.
Well, we didn't know that until Keller actually said it, okay?
Yeah.
All right? But I think that the more plausible reason is that... I'm sure you've been in this argument with professionals many times. You know, bloggers are great, but they can't do investigative journalism. You still need us to do the investigative
that
journalism.
That was definitely a theme.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's been a theme.
And Russ Bridger said the same
for
thing.
For years
yeah.
and years sure. and years. Yeah. No, I'm talking about before this.
Yeah.
If WikiLeaks represents journalism,
right.
we're now taking that away from them. It's no longer their distinction. It's something that they can play a role in. Julian Assange thought they
yeah.
could.
Yeah, so I'm with you on that.
They even said...
It's part of designating him other.
Right,
and
that's what I'm saying.
Expelling him from
if
the
they
tribe.
Make him yeah. other, then yeah. they don't have to address this issue that yeah. they still are clinging to. With, you know, which is kind of crazy because they ought to be embracing this whole thing far more seriously. That instead of viewing WikiLeaks as competition, which they both said they were doing, because they were both planning on replicating the functionality of WikiLeaks, or at least thinking about it. Right,
yeah.
They ought to be doing that with Twitter. They never run a critical piece about Twitter. I've never seen the Times do that.
Mm-hmm.
The Times runs puff piece after puff piece about Twitter. Gee, isn't it wonderful? Look at how it's doing this and that and the other thing. They're building a circle around the Times. It's far more threatening than WikiLeaks is. Yet they don't apparently see this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it would be... It's to watch them miss this point. It's
so they're thinking about building their own Dropbox. Why aren't they thinking about building their own Twitter? That's
they ought to be building their own Twitter. I've said this so many times.
I
mean, it's the medium. You know, and I wrote a piece about it where I think for myself, after listening to this talk, it sort of fell together. And I mean, it's a loop for me. I've been writing about this for at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... is that what they ought to be doing is they ought to be bringing their networks in, their communities ought to be, they ought to be drawing them closer to them. They ought to make themselves more indispensable.
When you say drawing them closer to them, what do you mean?
Build a Twitter and let's live there, okay? News is not a publication anymore, okay? It's an environment. It's Twitter. I mean, what do you think Twitter is? I mean, Twitter is a news environment. There's no publication date on Twitter, right? It's a constant
So the New York
stream.
Times should build its own news environment.
Absolutely, and use everything that they know about news to make it excellent.
But
and
isn't that what Huffington Post is much closer to doing?
They
and
are.
Isn't this why AOL wants them?
Yeah, Huffington Post is a lot closer.
Yeah.
Huffington Post is an embodiment of this idea. It's
yeah.
an imperfect embodiment.
I think that's the real logic of the deal, is in that.
Sure, absolutely. There are other publications doing this, like The Nation. The Atlantic Monthly. I'm sorry, I got confused. Not The Nation.
Yeah.
We're being interrupted. We're doing a show right now. Okay, you can't. We have to wrap this up.
Keep going.
Okay, no, the Atlantic Monthly, Fast Company, Wired is getting into this. I got an email from Evan Hansen about this.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, they asked me to write for them. I mean, on the same terms that Huffington Post did. You
well,
know?
Wait a minute. Let's say, how do you take a news site and make it into a news environment?
Oh,
what are some of the elements?
I didn't say they're making it into a news environment. This is really what's going on here. Okay, sorry. No, I didn't say that. I said they're bringing their community closer to them. That's what these guys are doing. None of them are building the
okay.
Twitter that they need to build.
Okay.
No. No.
So, right. All right. So, we agree on that. I think the New York Times, I've said this various times before, its first asset is its name, its second most important asset is its people, its third most important asset is the users and
right.
what they know.
Well, it's not users anymore. It's, you know, this is something Keller said that was extremely revealing. He said, our audience has moved to the internet. You know, I mean, he
yeah.
was talking about all the things. There were like, I forget what the other things were, but the audience has moved to the internet. And what I wanted to do, this is when I would have stood up and said, wrong, the sources moved to the internet.
Yeah.
It's your whole thing moved to the internet. The whole damn Megillah, every
right.
bit of it, it moved to the internet. You know, and what you're doing there is you're trying to keep the blinders on so that you don't have to look at what actually happened, which is such a shame, because what WikiLeaks proves is we do need the Times, and we do the Guardian more so, because the Guardian really did embrace it a lot better than the Times did. The Times sort of took a hands-off approach to WikiLeaks. They really did. Somebody said this, that they were going fast with it for the first 12 days or so, and then they just sort of kicked back and stopped doing it. Well, the Guardian stayed with it. Now the Telegraph's picked up. They seem to be doing fine, too. I've been getting lots of interesting stories from the Telegraph.
But we do need both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need them for the legwork, but we need them for the gestalts. We need them for creating the connections, for having that database. Keller even said this. I mean, this is really interesting. You know, who knew that you needed to... What's the vice president of Egypt's name? Something.
Seliman.
That's it. That's his name. Who even knew we need to look for him, right?
Yeah.
Now we do. Now we just do a search on the 850,000 cables we've got, and look, there's some
right.
stuff about him.
Yeah, building a searchable database of 850,000 cables, that's a big deal.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
And if you didn't know you needed WikiLeaks up till that point, that should have been the moment.
Right.
You know, that you said, oh, I get it. I see what we should be doing here
yeah.
with this. This is truly informing everything
well,
we're doing.
Well, Ross Bridger is way ahead of Keller in rethinking
Absolutely.
These things.
Absolutely. As is Emily Bell, way ahead of Terry Gross.
When when he says... We need to embrace the mutualization of journalism, where
yeah.
which is a term of his.
It's a beautiful term.
Yeah,
it?
Beautiful term, right? Because
yeah,
what it says is, hey, you guys know stuff, we know stuff,
right.
you have assets, we have assets, you're out there, we're in here.
Jay,
right?
this is
we
why
we can't
it was
be everywhere.
Such a crime that they went and destroyed their relationship with Assange. It's a crime. They shouldn't have done it.
Well, I also think it's a tragedy that Assange is becoming WikiLeaks. I think that's not a good thing.
Well, like it or not, that's the way these things work.
Where are the bank documents, Dave? Where's the next release?
You know, we'd be in a better position to have this conversation with him if these guys hadn't burned their bridges.
Well, the organization is slowing down. It's shutting down. It hasn't,
well,
it hasn't accepted new documents since 2010.
Also on trial.
Well, that's what I mean, though.
Okay, fair enough. But, you know, all right. I want to ask you something else
yep.
before we run out of time. Al Jazeera.
Amazing.
Talk about it.
Well, Al Jazeera is based in Qatar.
No, no, talk about what they're doing right now.
What they're
now.
Doing
yeah, yeah, yeah.
What, is so
what
much,
did you see?
What
you
I see is...
What did you see? I didn't get to see. I was in the blackout. I was in Utah while all this stuff was coming down.
Uh-huh.
I had lousy internet
oh.
and all...
Well, I could only see it online.
That's what I'm saying.
And
online was terrible, and all I got was Fox News.
Right. What I saw in comparison to CNN
right.
is hosts who know something versus on CNN hosts who know nothing. No background knowledge at all.
Yep.
On CNN, lots of analysts, especially people who they have contracts with to analyze events, who also know nothing because they weren't contracted for Egypt.
No.
Versus participants on Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, tons of video and reports from the scene. CNN, tape loops of stock of certain footage that they thought was, you know, speaks. Also, CNN doesn't even know it does this anymore, but it just runs footage of stuff without any labeling, without any context. You don't know what day it was. You don't know where it was from. Mm. You have absolutely no idea. It's as if footage is itself an act of journalism. Mm-hmm. And they're not even trying. And they just talk over it. And they almost literally use it as wallpaper, right? It's just video wallpaper. So there's that. Mm. You have, and the most important thing was, on Al Jazeera, hosts who are willing to actually argue with officials who are coming on to bullshit the world, who will actually try and show on the air that these officials are lying, versus what we've talked about many times about CNN. You know, he said, she said, leave it there. Mm. Okay. And also, you have this weird thing with CNN where it takes them 2 to 3 days to realize that they've got a huge international story building. If they are watching the wire, if they're watching the wires or Twitter or the networks, they
or
would
Al
know,
Jazeera,
or Al Jazeera, they would know right away. And what's really strange about that is that when they finally got onto the story and made it their story, their ratings went way up. They demolished the competition, right? So there's this strange lag there where they just don't seem to be able to hop on things that are supposed to be their things, right? Because the news is the star.
Breaking news.
Right.
They call the show the Situation Room.
Breaking news. 3 days later. You know?
This just into the Situation Room.
I just find that so strange.
Yeah. So, well, you observed something on Twitter about Christiane Amanpour had. The Press had some Ronald Reagan's birthday was the big story.
Christiane Amanpour 2 weeks ago was live from Egypt. The entire show was about that.
Right.
Even the Washington guests, which Jake Tapper handled, were about that.
Yeah.
And David Gregory on Meet the Press was doing Mitch McConnell and the budget negotiations. Then this week, Amanpour was again live for the hour entirely about Egypt. The roundtable she had ditched George Will entirely. Her roundtable was 5 reporters on the scene in Egypt. Hmm. That was the roundtable, right? And she had an original interview with the vice president, which was the first interview.
Right.
And Jake Tapper was doing Ronald Reagan's centennial.
You don't mean Jake Tapper, you mean...
I'm sorry, David Gregory
was
doing an hour on the Reagan legacy
right.
at the same time that Christiane Amanpour was live from Egypt. Earlier, yeah. But she got an interview with Mubarak, which wasn't on video, unfortunately.
See, this is why I think that it's roughly equivalent. What we have to overcome here is roughly the equivalent of what the Egyptians have to overcome with their government. What we have to overcome with our press. In other words, there's a deposition. They need to go, and
many of them need to go.
The whole thing needs to go. I don't think many of them need to go. I think the whole thing needs to go. And I think that I wrote this that coming back, what an A-B comparison. When I finally got back to New York, which was a week ago Sunday, all of a sudden I'm watching Al Jazeera on the net and. And I'm going way beyond just this is what I wanted from the coverage of Egypt to, this is what I wanted from news to, this is what I wanted from the net. Mm-hmm. In other words, I've said this many times is that, and Doc Searles did a wonderful job. He wrote this beautiful post about
cable.
We want it all unbundled, basically.
Right.
This bundle isn't serving anybody's interests, really, other than the corporate blogging, corporate video silos. So why do I need Al Jazeera to be on the cable networks? I don't particularly need them to be there. As long as I can get them over my internet connection, I'm okay right. with it. As are almost everybody who gives a damn about news. That's probably acceptable to them too at this point. And so the parade has passed them by, you know?
Yeah. Rather than reform these dinosaurs, let's just plug right. the net into the television.
However, Al Jazeera has sort of missed the boat on something here too. And I know that some of them listen to this podcast. So let me just say this, is that the way they cover the United States misses the point that we are not our cable networks.
We are not our government either.
That's probably true. Yeah. Maybe not as much as I would like it to be true. We should talk about all the books that I've been reading all these books about.
That's for next
The
week.
Meltdown of 2008.
One more thing about Al Jazeera.
Yeah.
And this really made the difference. Everybody at that network knows they are pro-democracy for the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
There's no confusion about it. And that infuse their coverage with purpose and direction.
Well, there were some moments when I thought they leaned over a little bit too far the other way. That
I
they
didn't
were
see
yes.
That.
Well, I'll give you. Let me give you an example. Okay, when do you remember when the guys on horseback and camel came riding in?
Sure.
How did they describe those people?
I don't know. How did they?
Pro Mubarak demonstrators. Those were not pro Mubarak demonstrators. Those were soldiers attacking citizens. That was the truth. I mean, you know, you could not go any further out on the unreality limb than to call them pro-Mubarak demonstrators. They weren't demonstrating. They were attacking and killing people. So, you know, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that they're just trying to bend over backwards the same way the liberal media elite try to bend over backwards to not screw up the Republicans' message too much, that they're trying to...
I would have a different interpretation.
What would your interpretation be?
I think this happens in journalism a lot. I think you misinterpret it, is when you're in a situation of uncertainty, you default to the description that is least likely to be wrong. And that's what it really is.
What?
When you're in a situation...
No, I heard what you said. Yeah. I heard the words.
Well,
but
that's all.
How does it apply to the situation?
Because at the time, they probably didn't know who exactly these people were. They probably had a lot of suspicions about it.
But look what they were doing. Were they behaving like demonstrators or were they behaving like soldiers?
I repeat what I said. When you don't know, you default to the description that is least likely to be
wrong.
All right.
Well, let's leave it there because I don't accept that. But,
okay.
You know, we'll pick this up again. Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Bye for now.